We will be in the beginning, essentially, the 11th chapter of Hebrews tonight. And as Chris said, I need to end up the class by saying, and that concludes the book of Hebrews. Right. So I want to say that in my recordings that I'm up to number 41 or 42. It's kind of hard to believe. It seems to me, since I'm teaching in the back, that we just started the book of Hebrews. But 41 or 42 weeks, is it not? So that's more than a month, according to my calculations. So, all right. before we begin, then, David, would you lead us in a word of prayer?
Dear Lord, we thank you.
Amen. All right, so I've got, I took somebody's advice and set my font up here to the maximum that I've got, so that's the best I can do. You all have got your own Bibles anyway. It's here for your edification if you can see what's on the board. And all it's going to be is just the Bible. Mickey told me that he quit making up PowerPoints because when he made up PowerPoints, it just seems like his class went south so often that, it wasn't worth his time to bother to make them up anymore. So anyway, so we shall proceed on through. Before we begin chapter 11, let's do a little review, as Mickey does and as I do in my class. And of course, I'm expecting that my students will answer all these questions and everybody else in here will go, "What?" We shall see. So, why is the book named Hebrews?
It's written to the Hebrews, the Jewish Christians.
Okay. One thing I'd like to get away from is using the term Jewish Christian. There is no such thing. Not that I want to embarrass you or anything, but I've pointed that out several times in our class that the Right. People who used to be Jews and are now Christians. But that's just one of my, pet annoyances, is that there is no such thing as a Jewish Christian. You're either a Jew or you're Christian. The gospel never talks about Jewish Christians. It never talks about hyphenated Christians of any kind. So, and the reason that I like to get away from that is because so many people use stuff like that today. I'm a Methodist Christian. I'm a Baptist Christian. There's Christian and then there's others.
Well, Jewish could also be ethnicity as well. So that's like a little bit different for me
to a certain extent. However, the Gospels always use the term Jew to refer to the religious propensity of the Hebrew people. the nationality is Hebrew. The religion is Jew. And it's not until they got to the Babylonian captivity, I think, that they were actually called Jews. And they were, it was a Babylonian or Assyrian, one or the other. It seems that that's like the first time that it's used in the Bible, is when they were in actual captivity. And one of the things that is mentioned in the Gospels is when Paul is writing to some of the folks that are Christians that used to be Gentiles. He says, "When ye used to be Gentiles." And so a lot of times we have a tendency to refer to Gentile Christians. The Gospel doesn't call them Gentile Christians either. Now, they are Christians that used to be Gentiles. Now, true. The actual technical definition of the word Gentile simply means nation. And so it's somebody that is not a Jew or not formally a Jew. So technically it works okay that way. But it's interesting to note that Paul does use the phrase when you used to be Gentiles. Okay, and when he does that, that indicates that they are then no longer Gentiles. So it comes down to the fact that we don't have Jews and Gentiles anymore. We've got Christians. We're all the same, as it were. Now, as a matter of fact, I think, though I'm not positive, never done any research on it, but I think a lot of times the Hebrew people who were Jews, which generally speaking was the vast majority of the Hebrew people, the Hebrew people who were Jews kind of looked down on those people that had converted to Judaism. So they still continued many times to refer to these people as Gentiles, even though they were of the Jewish religion. So anyway, that goes a long way in discussing why the book is named Hebrews. It's a good thing I didn't make a PowerPoint. That's right. There it is right there. But anyway. Now, the book of Hebrews is really a book of comparisons. And generally speaking, the book of Hebrews is a comparison of what?
Old to the new,
okay. And so we're talking about the Old Testament to the New Testament, the old system to the new system, all this stuff. So now when we look at the comparisons, though, and we look at chapter 1, what comparisons are made in chapter 1? Come on. Say that again.
Jesus to the prophets.
Jesus to the prophets, and what else? Okay, Jesus compared to the angels, but Jesus as deity compared to the angels. Now when we get to chapter 2, what comparisons do we have made? Okay, Jesus as a man compared to the angels. Okay, so there's the deity part spoken about in the majority in chapter 1, and then in chapter 2 we see we're talking about Jesus as opposed to the Christ. And in the first chapter is generally speaking talking about the Christ, in other words the Messiah, as he is compared to the prophets and the angels. And in the second chapter has to do with Jesus the man as he's compared to the angels. Chapter 3, what's our comparison there? Say that again. Right. So it's the comparison of Jesus to Moses. Now, what word is used in this book to show these comparisons?
Better.
Better. It's used how many times? 13 times. In 13 times in how many chapters in the book of Hebrews? 13. Okay. But better is not used in every one of the 13 chapters. So, but anyway, it's still used 13 times in the 13 chapters of Hebrews. So, so when we look at the comparison of Jesus to the prophets, Jesus to the angels as deity, Jesus to the angels as man, Jesus to Moses, who's better?
Jesus
is. Okay. Now, when it comes down to our comparison of Jesus with Moses, what is the relationship developed there in the household of God between the two? Yeah, it's sort of the way.
Not sure what you're fishing for, but
lawgiver. Uh-oh. Jenny had her hand up before Katie.
Hebrews 3:5, Moses indeed was faithful in all his house as a servant.
Okay. So Moses was a servant, and Katie, Jesus was what?
The son.
Okay. So what we have in the household of God in the comparison between Moses and Jesus is that Moses is the servant, and Jesus is the son. If Jesus is the son, then he is what? He's the inheritor, is he not? So, or the, what do you call it? The what? Heir. That word was right in the middle of that, yeah. So, he's the heir. And so, that's That's the relationship there. Now, when we come down to a sort of a definition of why the writer of Hebrews wrote the book of Hebrews, what verse should we come up with? Hebrews 4:1. Well, what does Hebrews 4:1 say, Sarah? Okay, so we have to fear lest any of us seem to have come short of his promised rest. Okay, essentially, that's the reason that the writer of Hebrews wrote the book of Hebrews, is because he doesn't want any of these people to have come short. Now, what comparison had he made going back into chapter 3? What had they come short of when we were talking about Moses? The promised land. An interesting thing in the commentary that was written by was it Dan King wrote, I think, this the truth commentary on this, is that when he talked about the discussion that is had about the people entering into the land of promise and comparing that with entering into the heavenly rest, he points out, and the New Testament also points out in Hebrews, that the people were not promised a land of rest physically by Moses or Joshua. They were promised a land in which the fields and the houses and the stuff that was there was not built by them, and they got to take it, but it was not the promised rest. It was a promised land. But what God promises us is a promised rest. Okay, and so there's a comparison there. And of course, me, from my worldly point of view, I certainly would want to have a land of rest as compared to a land of work, you know, whether, you know, sleep all day or whatever. But a lot of comparisons in there. Then when we start proceeding past chapter 4, getting to 5 and such like that, what are our comparisons being made there? What are we talking about in chapter 5 and going into... Say that again?
Priesthood.
The priesthood. Okay. And what two priesthoods are being compared? Okay. Is that what you said? And I didn't hear you? Okay. So we have the Aaronic priesthood or the Levitical priesthood and the priesthood of Melchizedek. Now, when it comes down to the Levitical priesthood, how is it divided up? David mentioned that the Aaronic priesthood. Now, what is that part? Who are they? Okay, and what? The high priest. Okay, the high priest comes only from the lineage of Aaron. Okay, and all the rest of the priests come from just out of the general tribe of Levi. Now, I can't imagine that there were that many high priest positions open that all of the people of the tribe of Aaron were high priests. I mean, obviously, there was my understanding from just reading around was that a high priest was appointed, and then he was high priest for the rest of his life. Matter of fact, when it comes down to the cities of refuge, it talks about that the person that goes to a city of refuge has to stay there until the death of the high priest. So, I think the succession was by the death of the high priest. Then, like his oldest son or somebody succeeded him. I don't know. I didn't look it up to see what it was. So, but I'm sure there are a lot more male people in the tribe of Aaron. And so they were still Levites, so they had things to do as priests also. So a lot of people that had stuff to do. Now, when it came down to the Levitical priesthood and the priesthood of Melchizedek, what's the difference there? How did Melchizedek stack up to... Okay. And then... Right. Okay. So he said that the Levites and Aaron paid tribute to Melchizedek because Abram did that, because they were direct descendants of Abram. Okay, so That's why we see then that he's already making the comparison between the Levitical priesthood and the priesthood of Melchizedek. Now, how often is Melchizedek mentioned in the Old Testament as compared to the New Testament? Twice in the Old Testament. That was, do we remember where? It was Psalms 110? Something like that. Anyway, it was in the Psalms once, and in the original story in the book of Genesis, which is like two verses long. Genesis 14. Okay, so in Genesis 14, and I think it's either Psalms 110 or Psalms 40, or one of the Psalms between 1 and 150 anyway.
110 verse 4.
Okay. So in those two places, the word Melchizedek is mentioned in the Old Testament. When we get into the book of Hebrews, it's mentioned all over the place. I mean, not a gazillion times, but it's mentioned a number of times, like 10 times. Well, a gazillion's sort of a general number. So Chris is telling me, you know, I've told you a million times not to exaggerate. So anyway, so the thing is that it just seems to me, my opinion, that God set up this whole arrangement for the purpose of his eternal purpose, Ephesians 3:11, that was discussed in the book of Hebrews. So the relationship between Melchizedek and Abram, and then therefore the comparison between the priesthood of Melchizedek and the priesthood of Levi or Aaron, was really discussed in full in the book of Hebrews. And it shows that the priesthood of Melchizedek, which Jesus was a part of, as you might say, though we understand he's not descended from Melchizedek or anything like that, that priesthood is better than the priesthood that God set up through Levi and set up high priest through Aaron. But what kind of high priest is Jesus called? A great, okay. Jesus called a great high priest. I don't remember in discussing or in looking through the Bible at all that any other high priest was ever called a great high priest. But Jesus, in the book of Hebrews, is not only called a high priest, but our great high priest. And so we see that even in that instance, Jesus is better. Now, if we look at all this, we look at the prophets, we look at the angels, we look at Moses, we look at the priesthood of Levi and the high priesthood of Aaron, and that later on, as we got into chapter 9, we're talking about the tabernacle and the implements that are in there. Why has the writer of Hebrews used all these figures? What do they represent in the Jewish religion? When it comes right down to a Jew looking at all of these things, he says, that's everything. He says, that's all of Judaism. That's all of my religion. He has taken everything that's important in the religion of the Jews and shown that Jesus is better than all of it. He's taken the most important things in the religion of the Jews and says, Jesus is better than all of this. He even took their father, Abraham, and said that he gave tribute to Melchizedek, and because of that, he was subservient, you might say, to Melchizedek. I mean, the Jews look at this, and they, you know, I can imagine them dropping their jaws. Now, these folks were Hebrews, people that had been Jews and converted to be Christians. And some of them, it appears from the context of the book of Hebrews, had been Christians for some time. Some for a couple of generations, perhaps, 20, 30 years, perhaps. It is supposed, and I think Mickey mentioned this, that the book of Hebrews might have been written around 5 years before the destruction of Jerusalem. So if we say that it was written around 65, and that the crucifixion of Jesus was around 33, something like that. So say it was 35 to 65. So that's approximately 30 years. some of these people may have been part of the crowd that was there in Acts, the second chapter. Especially since some of the commentators feel that I just completely lost my thought. I have to quit thinking more than one thought at a time, I guess. Anyway, so these people have been Christians, some of them, for a long time. And we look at many of us in this congregation and you say, well, a lot of them were probably Christians longer than we've been Christians. So these people knew better. Now, what was it that these people were supposedly trying to do?
Go back into the Jewish religion.
Sure. And why was that?
Well, Jewish religion was considered a recognized religion in the Roman Empire, and so they didn't get the persecution that the Christians got, so they went back into the Jewish religion, which they had been comfortable with prior to becoming Christian, and they could escape a lot of this persecution of the Christians.
Okay. So much of the persecution that might have been levied on the Christians could be taken away from them. But I think, and Mickey pointed this out, I think, last week also, who was their greatest persecution from?
Jews
themselves. Yeah. Who were saying, oh, you guys gave up this religion and you shouldn't have done that. You're bad people, you know. So there was a lot of persecution just coming from, you know, their own towns. Right, right, an accepted religion, right. Okay. I think that sort of kind of sums up where we are up to Hebrews at this time, leaving out, you know, major gaps here and there. But it's just that we need to know what we're talking about when we talk about it. And so it's a good idea to remind ourselves on a frequent basis just what it is that we're talking about. Now, who remembers the assignment that Mickey gave you last week? Jenny remembers, and Chris remembers, and Bruce what? You remember it? So several of us remember. Several of you remember, I should say. I listened to the CD several times. And what was that assignment? Okay. A little more specific. Okay. So the verb, he said, identify the verb that followed the noun, and I'm going, there's a lot of nouns in here. But he's meaning the proper noun. In other words, Abel, Enoch, things like that. What verb goes along with these people? Now, I just, before class, because I hadn't remembered to do it before, started writing down the ones that I got through from verse 2 through 28. And As I notice, it talks about the elders and Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham and Sarah, and it says, and the verb that goes with each one of them is that all they had to do was believe, right? Wasn't that it? That wasn't it. Oh, okay. You're right, it wasn't it. They didn't have to just believe. Why did, you know, because believe is a verb too, right? It's not a very active verb, but it is nonetheless a verb. So, but we have a lot of action verbs that go along with these words. So let's go through them. Who's got the first one? I've got one actually that I wrote down from verse 2. Okay. What do we got in verse 2?
Men of old gained.
Say that again.
Men of old gained.
Okay. Yeah. So, and in the American Standard, it talks about the elders. It said, had witness borne to them. Now, obviously, this is not something that the elders did, but there is a verb associated with this that indicates a certain amount of action. It wasn't on their part, but it says that the elders had witness borne to them. So we see it starting right off. Oh, one thing that, and the reason that I have this scrolled up to verse 38 is that when we look at chapter 11, what do we generally call chapter 11?
Hall of Faith.
The Hall of Faith, right? Does it start in chapter 11? No. I mean, even just a couple of verses up, we have the introduction to them. My righteous one shall live by faith. And if he shrink back, my soul hath no pleasure in him. But we are not them of them that shrink back unto perdition, but of them that have faith unto the saving of the soul. And so, here's the introduction to this chapter, which is the hall of faith. So, now he's making, really, he's starting off this chapter with a comparison of us. All right? So, my righteous one shall live by faith, they that have faith unto the saving of the soul. These are the people that he's talking about. And now, he's going to go, as he does, he's going to go back into the past and make comparisons. So, verse 2, we have, there's elders there. Okay, that's a person or something that like. So, they had witness born to them. Now, it doesn't use the word faith there. So, you know, that's, it's not like all the other uses. Okay. Now, but if we were to just key on the phrase by faith, which he didn't say to do, he said take the nouns and show the associated verb. But if we take the by faith stuff, which is used a lot in here, we can even look in verse 3. And it says, by faith who? We. And what do? We understand. So there's something that we have to do also. So once again, he's continuing sort of to introduce things to us. But now we get down to the people. And so who's this first person we're talking about? Abel. What did he do? Okay. Abel offered. So if we get right down to it, we see that Abel here, he offered to God. Now, his sacrifice was more excellent than that of Cain. And because Abel offered a sacrifice more excellent, he had witness borne to him that he was righteous. God bore that witness to him. So the action of Abel was that he offered a sacrifice that was more excellent. Now, when we look at the phrase more excellent, what one word can we put in there that's popular in the book of Hebrews?
Better.
Okay? So Abel's offering was better than Cain's. So that's an action that Abel took. All right? What's our next one? Enoch. Well, what happened to him? Okay, he was taken up or translated, as the American Standard says. And not only was he translated or taken up, but it says that he should not see death. Yes, sir.
As I went through, I focused on what the person did.
Right.
Because Enoch didn't take himself up.
No, he didn't, yeah.
And what Enoch did is not found until the very end of the verse.
Yeah. So when we look at that, that is, he was what?
He pleased God.
All right, he pleased God. So that's really when we want to look at this, we want to look at what did the person do. And obviously here, Enoch was translated. That was something that God did for him. But the purpose that he was translated is because he was well-pleasing to God. Randy.
And if you go back to the Genesis account, it says he walked with God.
He walked with God. Yeah, right. He walked with God, and he was not because God took him. Okay, yeah. So, all right. So, yeah, good point, because it's much like the it's much like this one up here that I mentioned about the elders. I mean, the elders didn't do anything. Somebody bore witness to them. Okay, so, but once again, it's a noun with an associated verb, but what I'm trying to point out is that we have action associated with these things. We don't have the just there's nothing for us to do, as it were. There's something that needs to be done. All right, so there was Enoch. Now, who's next? Noah. What did he do? Okay. Is that... The, Okay. The American Standard says, moved with godly fear, and I guess that's the phrase that in the King James is reverenced. Is that correct? Let me see. Verse 7. Moved with fear. Okay. Moved with godly fear. In reverence. There it is in the New American Standard. It talks about in reverence. In reverence, prepared an ark. And yeah, that's what the, obviously, that's what the phraseology means when you look at it. And you talked about the fact that when he was moved with godly fear is that reverence that we're talking about. We revere God. Okay?
He also condemned.
Yes, I think I wrote that down. Let me see. Did I? I guess I missed that part. Whoops. What? All right. Oh, yeah. Move with prepared, through which he condemned the world. Okay. All right. And then also in verse 8, what did he do? Oh, I'm sorry. Another person. Sorry. I'm getting ahead of myself here. So, all right. So Noah moved with godly fear or revered God or whatever. He also prepared an ark, right? So there's a thing he did there also. And that was something that went a small portion to, you know, saving them. So he prepared an ark. And as is pointed out, he also condemned the world because of that. How is it that Noah condemned the world? All right. Say what? He did invite them into the ark. That's true. He invited them into the ark, and how many of them took him up on it? Nobody. Right. Mrs. Noah and the three sons and their wives, right? Something like that. That's what it appears, yeah. So he preached for 120 years and managed to get 8 people in the ark. Okay. So the simple fact of God closing up the ark and deluging the world with water by default caused Noah to condemn the world. In other words, Noah was saved alive and the other people died.
Yeah, that same in John 3:16, for God so loved the world, he sent his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth in him should not perish but have everlasting life. The very next verse, for God sent not his Son into the world to condemn the world, that the world could not be saved. But to be saved if they accept the Son.
That's right. Yeah. There's so much that people have a tendency to leave out. They say, ooh, I like that verse. Well, we'll just keep that. And, you know, like Mickey said a number of times, and all of us say a number of times, context, context, context. You know, see what's coming out of here. All right, now verse 8. Obviously, the father of the Jewish faith, as far as the Jews were concerned. And so, what did Abraham do? Say that again. Okay, and what was it? He obeyed. Okay, so when we look in verse 8, we say there's Abraham, and he was called by God. What did he do? He obeyed. And he went. That's right, because in the next just couple words, it says obeyed to go out unto a place. So he took out... and went back went to the place where he was told to go by God. And so it says that twice in that verse. He obeyed to go out unto a place, and then later on it says, and he went out. And he went out knowing not where he went. What also did he do? Look in verse 10. Another one in 9? Oh. I'm sorry. Yeah. All right. He became a sojourner in the land of promise. So not only did he need to go, but there was a place he needed to abide, as it were, or stay for at least a little while. Sojourner simply means a person that's, kind of moving around. Yeah. A visitor. Dwelling in tents with either. And here's where Bruce's point about they become heirs with him of the same promise. Now, in verse 10, what did he do? He looked, okay? He looked for the city which hath the foundations, whose builder and maker was God. Now, do we expect that Abraham went out there looking for a physical city that God had built? No. So, once again, we see the allusion, even from the Old Testament, about the fact that the people at that time were looking forward to something more than what they had in the law of the Jews or in the law of Moses. And toward the end of this chapter, we see it reiterated, and I'm sure that we'll get to that one if we ever get to the end of the chapter. So that was 10. And then now who do we have after Abram? Sarah, his wife, right? And what did she do? Now, where's the what she did part in here? Okay, she could, yeah. Right, she counted him faithful, or she considered God faithful. So down toward the end of the verse there is that Sarah counted him faithful who had promised. Now, there was another noun associated with that, but that was something that God gave to her. Sarah, it says, herself received power to conceive seed. Okay, so Sarah didn't do that. God did that on her behalf. Okay, so when it comes down to actually what Sarah did, she counted him faithful. So she was a faithful person herself. Randy?
She witnessed a miracle.
She witnessed a miracle what? Witnessed a miracle and believed, yeah. Now, do we see people who witnessed miracles and didn't believe? Yeah. I guess I wouldn't say all the time, but... Right, right. Even when they were, Acts 4? It says, for indeed a notable miracle has been performed and we cannot deny it. Yet, they continued to beat him and said, don't do that anymore. You go, well, technically speaking, they didn't believe the miracle then, did they? I mean, they saw that something had been done, and they should have believed, but they didn't. They just said, I don't know whether it's at that place or in an earlier or later place, it says that, well, if we allow this stuff to come, to continue on, the Romans will come down and take away our place. You know, we'll lose our jobs. John 11? Okay.
So, like on the Sarah, then, what we're saying is she believed because of the miracle?
She, you know, the thing is that when it says that she received power to conceive seed, she did that because she counted him faithful who had promised. Okay, so all that we have said there is that Sarah believed him because he promised her. Yeah. So it was before she realized that she was pregnant, or before she was pregnant. But certainly, I'm sure that the fact that she was able to conceive at her relatively old age. Yeah, that's right. So we want to call her age as relatively old here, because those of us that approach that, you know, we want to think of them as young. So anyway, but... all right, so in verse 11, we're talking about Sarah. I don't think there's anything else there. Now, interestingly enough, verse 13 has a noun in it, though not a proper noun. And what is verse 13 talking about right at the beginning? These these people that we've been talking about, they died in faith. They hadn't received... Oh, this is the one that I was thinking about. They didn't receive the promises that were given by God. Given by God where? Genesis 12, something like that. You know, all these promises that we had along of the nation, the seed, the land. you know, these people that we've looked to so far, up through Sarah, they didn't receive any of these promises. Okay. Now, of course, some of these people were before those promises were made, but God had made promises throughout. And of course, as we see in the grand scheme of things, with God, things seem sort of to roll forward and backwards. I mean, we see that that it is the sacrifice of Jesus that allows the forgiveness of sins of people behind us, not just the people before us. We want to keep in mind that God is sort of a person that is, what would we say, Chris, timeless, or it would appear that the time is of no, doesn't appear as of any consequence to God, or he's not bound by time. We would say that he lives outside of time. When we look at things throughout, if we look at the whole span of the Bible, we might say that God's kind of looking, you know, all the way through from both ends, and seeing all the way to the beginning and all the way to the end and everything in the middle, from, you know, like it was all right now. In verse 13 it says these all. So we've so far talked about elders and Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abram and Sarah, and we see that these all, what did they do? What did these all do? They greeted these promises. It says, will you stop? Computers can be irritating at times. Okay, these all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them, in other words, the promises, and greeted them from afar, and having confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So these people, these all that we've just talked about, they didn't receive promises, but they did see them. They saw glimpses of these promises. They greeted them from afar. In other words, these people were removed from these promises, but they still sort of looked forward to them, even perhaps knowing that they themselves of their generation would not receive these promises. It doesn't say that here, but that's, you know, it would appear sort of that way. And it says that they greeted them, and what other thing they do? They confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And so in this instance, they confessed or showed by the things they did or the things they said that they did not consider this world to be their home. So strangers and pilgrims, not in the land of Canaan, not in the land of Egypt, but strangers and pilgrims on the earth. So these people, even way back then, as far as Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abram and Sarah, these people way back at the beginning of almost the beginning of time as we look at it, that these people looked forward to the promises, and that they themselves confessed that they were just pilgrims on this earth. That's interesting, because we think so much about, when we think of the law of Moses, for example, that it was a very physical kind of law, that the people that were strict adherents to it, that they tried to do everything by the letter of the law. But when we look at Matthew 23:23, we see that they did the letter of the law, but they left undone the spirit of the law. So these all then. And I think I wrote something else down in just 13. I said they greeted and they confessed. Oh, and in verse 13 also, I put down they desire a better country. Where do I see that? Oh, yeah. There it is. Yeah, 16. They desire a better country. So why did I put 13 down? All right. So they. All right. So in 13 they confessed, they greeted, and such alike as that. Says, but they desire, verse 16, a better country. And once again, we see it pointed out that they're looking at the heavenly thing even back then. So they desire a better country that is a heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed of them to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. set my alarm here so it goes off and lets me know when to be quiet. all right. So now we have all these people up and down the time scale here who we've been talking about. And now we go back to one that we've looked at just a little bit before. And who's next? Abraham again. What did he do? He offered. Okay. Now, in this instance, what did Abraham offer?
His son.
Yeah, he offered up his son. even though in this son it was said, your seed shall be called. What is the comparison that's made in other places in the New Testament? Okay. All right. Now, God gave up his son, and what happened to his son after his death? He was raised up, right? And what does it say that Abram thought was going to happen with his son? He would be raised up. He said, as a matter of fact, it said in a figure, he was raised back up. Okay? So, Ken?
We notice too, it's both their only begotten sons, begotten being their only.
Yeah, well, that's true. So, it talks about the only begotten son. I didn't realize that, but his only begotten son is mentioned, I think, a number of times in the New Testament regarding Jesus Christ. So, all right.
At that point, though, Sarah kind of unsaid that she was kind of faithful in the earlier verse.
Right.
Because she was waiting. And there was Isaac and Ishmael, but Isaac was the only one Sarah.
Oh. Yeah, right. Right, right. So Ishmael born of Hagar and Isaac born of Sarah. Right. All right. Now, so we see in verse 17, Abraham, he offered up his only begotten son. And then, and also in verse 19, we see another thing that he did. Oh, yeah. All right. So if we go back to Genesis 12, who are we talking about there that received the promises? Let's look at it real quick here. We'll go to Genesis 12. Now Jehovah said to Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred and from thy father's house unto the land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation. I will bless thee and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and him that curseth thee I will curse, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So we see that in Genesis chapter 12, the promises indeed were made to Abram or Abraham. And I think that that's probably what he's talking about here in 17. It says, he that had gladly received the promises, Abraham, chapter 12 of Genesis, was offering up his only begotten son, even he to whom it was said, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. So these sentences go together. And it's obvious that this is not in the verse 18 is not referring to Jesus, because it says, in Isaac shall your seed be called. So anyway. So as we look at this, we realize that that we have Abram here, and he also in verse 19 he accounted that God is able to raise. So essentially, what he's saying is in verse 19 is that he trusted God to raise up Isaac even from the dead, and there it is there. From whence he also in a figure did receive him back. Okay. All right, we will quit there and start in verse 20 of Hebrews chapter 11 next week, or wherever Mickey wants to start.